For me, I'm only connected to the intention. I'm not connected to the end outcome. So I often tell myself this constantly that, the kind of change that I'm aspiring towards may not show up in my lifetime, and that's okay. As long as I'm working towards it, I will find peace. And so my joy comes from just the intention and the process that comes with working towards that intention. And if I have the great privilege of being able to see let's say, massive outcomes that I'd love to see for our world in my lifetime, fantastic. If I only get to see droplets of it, that's also incredibly humbling. But I think when we disconnect ourselves from the end outcome, we can still hold true to the urgency for reform without the weighted pressure of having to see results very, very quickly. So that's the approach I've taken.
Welcome back to Paths to Purpose. Thanks for joining us this week. We did not have a new episode last week because I was finishing my first year of law school. So thankfully that is done. And this week we are back with another guest. So we're really excited to get back into that. We hope that kind of giving everyone a week off of new material to cover maybe gave you some time to be introspective and to kind of work through some of the material that we've covered so far. This week we are joined by Abdullahi Alim. Abdullahi currently leads the Davos Lab at the World Economic Forum, a citizen-centered policy and impact incubator for nations seeking to rebuild after the worst economic, public health, climate, and social justice crises of our time. Abdullahi also leads 100-plus youth-led movements across Africa and the Middle East as the World Economic Forum's regional focal point for the Global Shapers community. Prior to this, Abdullahi served as the deputy CEO of PAVE, the largest non-government counterterrorism body in Oceania, where he oversaw novel research and practice seeking to disrupt the recruitment tactics of hate and militia groups. He is also on the Global Advisory Board for the Apolitical Foundation and a member on the Board of Trustees for the Queen's Commonwealth Trust. Abdullahi, thank you so much for joining us this week and welcome to Paths to Purpose.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
We're excited to chat with you today. Could we maybe start by talking about what you do currently and your path to getting there?
Sure. So I'm currently leading a very exciting project called the Davos Lab. The project basically is a response to the worst, as you mentioned, economic, public health, social justice, and climate reckoning that we've had in our particular lifetime. And we know, just based off what we saw in 2008, that majority of these the implications of these crises come to bear a few years after the very crisis. So the real costs of the 2008 financial crisis came up years after, through the anger that was demonstrated through the Occupy Wall Street movement, for example, or through the organized protests of young people across the Middle East, which came to be known as the Arab Spring. And what we saw a year before the COVID crisis is that a lot of the communities that were reeling the effects of the 2008 financial crisis only just recovered and are now again hit with a second wave far bigger than the very first one. And so we thought this was a prime opportunity for us to reckon with the fact that our economic and political systems simply do not work. And to take a more cynical view, if they do work, they are operating in a way that just perpetuates dysfunction.
So, how did you end up there? Can we maybe back up a little bit and talk about how you started out and how did you get involved in community organization?
I think for me, I often tell people that one of the best things about being where I am today is that I've worked extremely hard and the results have come to bear. That's a very optimistic view of it. I think the realistic view is that I am an exception to the rule. So I and my family sought asylum in Australia when I was six. And I went through a public, not a public, sorry, I went through a low-income independent institution at the time in Australia that wasn't particularly ranked quite highly. I also didn't necessarily grow up in, let's say, a household that had many opportunities too. So I'm also a product, I would say, of low-income housing and public housing as well. And so I think throughout my adolescent years, I saw very quickly that many people simply do not have the luxury of being able to withstand the pressures of failing public housing, education, criminal justice, you name it. So any one of these fracture systems that are often the cause of our disadvantage, the very communities that I've come from. And so being the exception to the rule, again, is a very humbling position to be in because you feel grateful every day, but it's also one that has quite a daunting, it comes with a daunting experience too, because you realize that it's really just by sheer chance. And that to really create a dent, we really need to look at the systemic issues that are at the core of why people still experience disadvantage. And I've dedicated my life to doing that. And I have to admit, I'm quite agnostic to the medium that takes. Maybe tomorrow I'll be working for an NGO that does that. Perhaps the day after I'll be in a government public sector role where perhaps I might not be as well recognized in the public sector machinery as just being one of 10,000 people, let's say. But that's really my cause and that's really my passion. And I have the great fortune of saying that between the ages of at least 24, 25 up until now, I'm 28 years old now, I've had the great opportunity to go through learning lessons at the World Economic Forum, one of the leading institutions of the world, to practice and to see from this vantage point, how do we shift systems of inequality? How do we shape public attitudes? And how do we also reallocate resources in ways that allow us to really bring to bear these more equitable outcomes for minority communities? So my journey really is rooted in the fact that I come from a place of disadvantage. And I think maybe experiences that people, peers my age, come to understand later in life is something that I had the, I would say, unfortunate circumstance of living through and understanding quite early, that you are the result of the systems that sit above you. If they are fractured, so too are your life. And when you are an exemption to that rule, you have the luxury to either continue and enjoy the life that you have post that, or you can take on the sometimes daunting responsibility of having a role in mending those fractured systems. I opted for the latter.
So Abdulali, thank you for joining us. I mean, it's such a remarkable story and one of clarity that you have on purpose. A lot of our listeners would probably share the appreciation for the urgency of purpose here, but they would become overwhelmed by the magnitude of it, particularly at the level you're thinking of it. How do you deal with it being overwhelming?
For me, I'm only connected to the intention. I'm not connected to the end outcome. So I often tell myself this constantly that, the kind of change that I'm aspiring towards may not show up in my lifetime, and that's okay. As long as I'm working towards it, I will find peace. And so my joy comes from just the intention and the process that comes with working towards that intention. And if I have the great privilege of being able to see the let's say, massive outcomes that I'd love to see for our world in my lifetime, fantastic. If I only get to see droplets of it, that's also incredibly humbling. But I think when we disconnect ourselves from the end outcome, we can still hold true to the urgency for reform without the weighted pressure of having to see results very, very quickly. So that's the approach I've taken.
Are there any financial security concerns that come up when you might pursue a career path like yours?
I always worry about it. And I think even when I come to a place of financial security, quote unquote financial security, I will still have that because I'm still a product of a welfare mentality. So I think you'll always have that feeling of not being financially secure. What I often recommend, and it's what I did and it worked for me so far, is do both. Work the job that pays, but also use your evenings and weekends very strategically to do the work, the longer term work, that'll allow you to live through to that purpose. A job is really just a means to that. So I did many 9-to-5s along with being, for example, the working for PAVE back in Australia, because it was an NGO and I wasn't paid too highly, to be honest. And that wasn't because of my boss or anything like that. In fact, no, I had a fantastic boss. It was just endemic of the sector that I was working for. But I took other roles. And I took other roles that aren't on my CV. I took other roles that really just gave me cash flow. But that's how you do it. And so for me, I wasn't willing to give up one over the other. I did both. And I'm still committed to doing both until the very end.
I think one question I have while listening to your story is, how did you kind of, when you were younger and when you were approaching your career opportunities, how did you decide to kind of go into the more public service and public interest jobs? Like, you've described your past and how that has always been rooted in kind of your purpose and who you are, but how did you approach actually tangibly going out and finding those positions?
One thing I should just add is that I actually studied actuarial science and finance as my undergraduate degrees. And thank God, in hindsight, I say thank you to all those private sector bodies that said I was not a cultural fit at the time, because it ended up working perfectly for me, because I certainly wasn't a cultural fit in many ways. And it geared me towards, I think, what was more effective for me. I think one thing that really helped was just volunteering as well on the side. I think it, like, I often say, like, we have to see ourselves as the hustler generation, you know, like we have so much up against us, 100% true. And while we work to kind of address those issues, I also think we need to hustle our way to figure out, if I do this volunteer opportunity, if I take on this, if I take on this particular project that has like-minded people, even if it's not paid, with other young people, for example, will that put me in the right circles, in the right spaces where it improves my critical thinking, it improves my confidence, it improves my outlook, it improves my longer term planning? I have to say, one of the biggest interventions that I've had, perhaps the single biggest interventions that I've had, was joining the Global Shapers community of the World Economic Forum. So now I'm kind of running it for Africa and Middle East, but before then I was just a member. And a member, I don't say just a member as like something dishonorable, but that was the world that I had. And at the time, I remember just being part of a Facebook group of 10,000 volunteers from 450 cities around the world. And you're beginning to see how young people in Bogota and how young people in Madrid and Manama and Calcutta and just so many different other parts of the world are approaching this. And they're approaching it with that same hustle. They have a 9-to-5, or maybe they might not have that luxury. Maybe they're taking on part-time gigs, or maybe they're part of the gig economy to give them at least some baseline financial security. But at the same time, I do 9 million other things. And sometimes their big break happens when they're in their 30s. Sometimes they land that in their 40s. Sometimes it happens still when they're in their 20s. But I just found a group of people who were quite happy in that journey too. And it was just phenomenal to be part of that process. Now, having dig deeper into it, of course, you know, we are still young people and we are still very much learning. And so there was a lot more depth to my initial observation. But the reality, I think overall reality still stood true, which was, it was a group of people who were happy with being a work in progress and took joy in the fact that while they had financial security, even at a very limited baseline, they were more involved in trying to be part of this global ecosystem of change. And that's really what brought them joy. And I have taken that honestly as my tagline. I will always be a work in progress, never a piece of work, never a finished product. And see, that's something that I only got from being part of these volunteer circles. It's the outlook, it's the mentality, it's just the drive and the ability rather to operationalize an intention. Because a lot of people want to create change, but the ability to operationalize that really came from this 10,000 peer group that I only really accessed mainly through Facebook.
Who advises you? Do you have advisors, or are you listening primarily to your own internal compass? Where do you look for input?
Myself directly, I would say, I have gone down the route of trying to look for mentors. And again, it goes back to just like, you know, early 20s Abdullahi, who tried knocking on every single door. And I think every single mentor's door. And, you know, maybe at that time I just wasn't as refined as maybe I am today. And so a lot of people didn't really see that I could potentially step up to the challenge. And so I found it difficult to find mentors at that time, late teens, early 20s, super, super, super difficult. Things changed for me when I came across a mentor who looked like me. And I met her at a US embassy event that was taking place in Australia at the time. It's just ridiculous for me to share this, but it just shows you how out of my depth I was. I was a student wearing a backpack. I had sandals on. I was at a formal event hosted by the US embassy at the time. And so even for me back then, I had no idea that I was out of place. I thought I was doing perfectly well, but I was completely out of my depth. And I think so often I was interacting in spaces where, you know, for me, I had to commute a long way to get to that event. But for the rest of them, they lived around the block of the US ambassador, for example, just to show that kind of big income gap. And I did see, for example, once this Zimbabwean woman who was at the event, and she would tell you that I essentially stalked her all the way back to her car. And I said, I would like for us to catch up. And I terribly said, but I don't have money. So if it is going to be over coffee, I will have to ask you to pay for my coffee, which is terrible to share, but that's where I was, to be honest. And it really started from that point onwards that I was able to find people like her who were so committed to really seeing me as somebody who was a work in progress. And I would make mistakes, but I always wanted to learn too. That's the one part. The second bucket of work, and I have to say this because, again, it's so rooted in my religious upbringing, is my name literally translates to servant of a higher power, servant of the universe, servant of God, whatever you want to call it. And I find that my best version always shows up when I'm listening to that. So whatever it is for you, whoever's listening to this, if it's guided meditations, if it's going for a walk, for me, sometimes it looks like the structured prayers that my ancestors have been doing for hundreds of years. Whatever it is that works for you, do that. Because that's when you wake up to the consciousness of your own life. And that's when that inner compass is also woken up, you know? And so for me, the best version of myself shows up when I'm doing these guided prayers, at least for me, 5 times a day. It starts with the sunrise, it ends post sunset. And in those deep reflections, I'm able to develop a very, very intimate and strong friendship, not only with the higher power, but also with a deeper sense of myself. And surely, slowly but surely, you attract the right people into your life. And so that for me, it comes in two forms. One was knowing who I was, but also at the same time, having the luxury of people who looked like me, who ended up showing up in the places that I was desperately trying to find some kind of familiarity around, but were very foreign to me.
I think just listening to how self-assured you are is so encouraging to not only me as a, you know, young person still finding my way, but also I'm sure to a lot of our listeners. One question we usually ask our guests is about imposter syndrome and kind of if you've dealt with imposter syndrome at all. Have you ever dealt with imposter syndrome? And if you have, kind of how do you deal with it?
I always do and I still do. In fact, I was in a meeting before this podcast where I had that for, I would say, 45 minutes of the hour. So it always shows up, and I've just kind of, over the years, developed a little bit more familiarity of when it shows up, just to recognize that. And also, I think what I found to be very liberating is to be able to see that other people also have this too, especially those who are far higher up. It's not something that's going to go away. And I know that sounds scary to some listeners now to know that it won't go away, but that also is somewhat comforting too, because it's something that allows me to connect more intimately with other people too. I also think to some degree, I have a unintended benefit to having an imposter syndrome, at least for me, which is it always, always grounds me. It always brings me back to reality. So even when I'm thinking, oh my God, I've done it and I'm doing it. And it shows up at a time when, you know, I always say this, never ever really a deficit on minimizing your ego, like in life. And so if that could also do that, fantastic. When it comes into the space where it's unfortunately adding to anxiety, that's the part where I think it becomes problematic. And I think for me, at least, it's just a case of recognizing, acknowledging, and knowing that every single person has it. And anytime you go into a job interview, even when you meet a group of friends for the first time, perhaps it's your first day of college, you will always be operating, not in real time, but you will be performing a theater of sorts. Everybody's acting and everybody's trying to put their best version forward. And that is bound to create some degree of an imposter. And so when you are able to just acknowledge that it's actually quite a normal experience, and when you see it in somebody else and you do not punish it, but in fact, you love it in them too, slowly but surely, you'll be able to find joy in yours too.
Yeah, I think that's a super way of framing that. I agree. I think virtually everybody deals with imposter syndrome at some point. And that's a really clever way of approaching thinking through that. So one question I have is, how does one approach identifying roles on where to start with sort of change projects and social projects?
I mean, I would say, like, if it's more comfortable, start as the observer, not necessarily the practitioner. So see if you can join a volunteer circle, and you don't necessarily have to pick up the heavy weight on your first go, but you can at least be around a group of people who you can understand how they frame a problem, how they frame a solution, how they operationalize a change project, how they measure the outcomes from that too, how they sample conversations from, you know, at-risk communities. Start from a place of observation. Maybe that might be the easiest way. And I in fact would encourage that, because you can't truly solve something that you cannot also diagnose. And so if you spend most of your time, you know, trying to diagnose, trying to understand, honestly, it'll inch you one step closer towards taking that leap of faith. Also at the same time too, I know it's a bit of a cliche. The reality is you can't change the entire world, but you can change one person's world entirely. And when you do change one person's world entirely, I mean that literally, you have changed their entire world. And that's not something to be overwhelmed by. To be able to change one person's reality, it's certainly within the reach of every single one of us. We all have the platform to do that. That's something that should humble us. That should be something that drives us, never something that should overwhelm us. Because when you're overwhelmed by that, it'll stagnate you. It'll freeze you to the point where you will be completely, completely oblivious to just the talents that you could easily impart on one person's world that could change their entire vision of and the entire experience, let alone more than one.
I wanted to ask if we could use one of our starter questions on you. These are kind of questions that we usually ask at the beginning of when we're working with students. So is that okay?
Yes.
Okay. So we use these to kind of source emotional resonance. And obviously you're very self-aware and you use lots of introspective tools already. But one of the questions I was really interested in asking you, because you've literally met the Queen of England, you've had conversations with Harry and Meghan. If you could have coffee with anyone in the world, whom would it be? What would you ask? And what would you hope to learn from the conversation?
This might sound very strange, and it's really based off of something that I watched last night, but I would love to listen to, have coffee with the spouse of a former autocratic leader. So somebody who lived in the fame of somebody who was very corrupt, and because that corrupt person fell, their lifestyle and all of what it came with also fell. So they also fell into oblivion. I want to realize like what's left of you, because so much of you was attached to that very corrupt spouse. So much of your ability to convene powerful people, your ability to just, and I just feel like there are so many rich life lessons in that. When you're able to go to bed and reckon with the fact that you are next to potentially somebody who has negatively and adversely impacted the lives of so many people, and you stay because of the benefits that it brings, I want to know what are the learning lessons that come today when that goes away.
That's actually one of the most fascinating responses. I've asked that question many times, and that's one of the most interesting and in-depth. And what I love about that response too is it's very authentic about the humanity and understanding the fundamental underlying humanity of that person and their story. It's really interesting. It actually pivots me to a related question about how do you deal with famous people, with important people, people with titles? How do you interact with them? Are you ever intimidated by them? How do you communicate with them?
I hate when I am, to be honest, but it really only shows up when I truly admire someone. And that could be somebody that's not potentially like known in pop culture to the extent of, let's say, a Queen or like Harry and Meghan. But for me, at least, I've seen them in enough documentaries or maybe I've read enough about them to know, wow, you've got a really interesting story and you've got interesting life lessons that I'd like to kind of unpack. I will be intimidated. I think I get upset at myself, to be honest, when I do have those moments show up, and it's the conversations that I have with myself after that make it easier for the next interaction. So like I might have acted a certain way and just be like, why did you do that? Why did you think that acting this way would give you more attention? Why did you want more attention? Why did you think that even though you're one of 100 people that you met that day, that acting that certain way would be useful? Like, for the most part, I can't answer them. And so, yeah, I'm at a stage now where I'm more in line with, here's my message, and do you have the platform? Do you have the utility at hand to be able to extend it? If so, great. If not, also no issue, but no longer intimidated by the brand and what comes to it. Like for me, I'm so, even when I had the conversation with Harry and Meghan, I was so in like advocate mode. I knew exactly what I wanted to say. And I'm like, keep in mind the hundreds of thousands of people that are going to watch this just purely off the fact that the two of them are there. They have such a massive platform. And so for me, I'm like communicating to that audience, and they were kind enough to allow their symbolic capital and their brand to take us to that audience group. But that leg, that extra leg that they presented, wasn't something that intimidated me. It excited me. It made me realize, oh my God, this will even reach even more people. And so, like, get your act together, Abdullahi.
I think what inspires me the most about your journey and kind of what you've been sharing with us today is just how passionate of an advocate you are, and how everything you do comes back to your purpose, and it's rooted in this desire to fundamentally help other people. And everything that you're talking about your own self-reflection, but also just the work that you do every day, just fundamentally goes back to that. And that is so spectacular. And I think what we are aspiring for our listeners to learn how to do. So thank you for sharing that with us today. I wanted to ask before we wrap things up, is there anything that you want to share with our listeners kind of along the lines of books, articles, tools, things that you've used in the past to kind of help you become more self-aware, find these opportunities for yourself, and just kind of things that will help people when they're throughout this learning process of kind of what they want to do, who they want to help, and where they want to engage?
I'm going to make it very simple. I think YouTube is the most underrated resource on this front. If you have issues around imposter syndrome, you will find so many rich resources. And the best thing about YouTube and its algorithms is that usually the best ones show up first. So it could be a lecture. It could be so sometimes what I watch are lectures. Sometimes it's religious sermons. Sometimes it's clips from an Oprah interview where she's discussing this topic with a famous psychologist, for example. There is so much, and I often just start by Googling the issue. And I know that sounds strange, but I honestly, honestly do that. And I go through a whole trove of data, and I go for a long walk sometimes where I'm listening to maybe 20 4-minute videos throughout that on maybe one given topic or another given topic. I then would have conversations with people about that. So anyone who's willing to listen, to be honest. And so that's kind of my philosophy too, is that, you know, maybe it's just a product of the fact that, you know, I was also a middle child of 8 kids. And so I spent a lot of time on the internet. YouTube was my friend. So I did spend a lot of time on that platform and just listening to people and, you know, seeing how people, you know, framed the ways in which they thought. I understood words that when I even spoke them made me more assured in what I was saying, because it's not that I'm sad. I need to find a deeper word that reflects my state right now, for example. And yeah, I would just say, for me, that was incredibly helpful. Two, of course, I will never, ever underestimate the true value of having a very, 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 very strong support network. My support network is my family and also friends. And when I say friends, I'll be honest, majority of them are not my age. Majority of my friends are at least 20 years older than me. It's just by the fact that those were the people who I resonated with the most, because I'm a bit of an old soul, and who were kind enough to also impart their friendship back to me too. So yeah, I would say it's a combination of that. Look for videos. I think videos are often much better than written text, where people are having conversations on an issue you want to hone in on. Speak to people about that, build your vocabulary around that. And I think slowly but surely you'll become more, more self-assured. Can I just say one other thing, which is, I think, 2-3 years ago, I reached the point where I was feeling quite guilty for the way in which I approached my work. I was often told, you're way too emotionally connected to these issues. You need to put a break on this. We need to be professional. We need to do this. We need to do that. And it wasn't necessarily coming from a bad place. These were people who were trying to help me mature in my style and my approach. And where I've eventually landed is, you know, knowing who to show your most authentic self to, and then knowing who to just give a very, very mild, tame version of how you think and how you feel. And knowing how to kind of build that muscle that tells you, you know, extend at this point, refrain at that point, has also been really, really wonderful for me. Because initially I was sharing everything with everyone, and it just got to a point where people thought, you're far too abstract, far too flamboyant, far too pretentious, and it's just getting difficult for people to reckon with you. And I what I did was I shrunk. I became a much smaller version of myself. And it basically was a version of myself that didn't trust myself. And because of that, I wasn't able to trust others too. So I'm now getting back to that point where I just say, you know what, I decide which parts and how far of myself I want to show to different people. And that has also helped me really.
The clarity you bring to the table is remarkable. And this is one of the reasons why I've started introducing interpersonal dynamics curriculum and awareness and trust and fundamentally understanding self and listening to self and understanding how we interact with other people. I can't say enough how much I appreciate you participating in this project that we're doing right now, to be candid. I want to bring you back for more.
Can I come for episode 2?
I'll buy the coffee too, by the way.
Yes.
Oh, I love that. Just to kind of echo what Alan said, thank you so much for giving us some of your time today to chat with our listeners. And before we wrap, I wanted to ask if you have any kind of projects, social media, work, websites, anything that you want to share where people can find you or the work that you're doing if they're interested.
Yeah, no, I'm on all social media. I'm more on Twitter than the other platforms. And I'm also on LinkedIn as well if you want to connect on a professional question too. So
great. Well, thanks everyone for listening this week. As per usual, if you have any thoughts or feedback that you want to send our way, our Instagram is at paths2purposepod or our email is paths2purposepod@gmail.com. Thank you, Abdullahi, for joining us this week, and we'll see you next week. Thanks, guys.